For almost 40 years, DR Power Equipment has been the go-to for homeowners who want professional-level outdoor power equipment. Whether you're managing acres of overgrown fields or just want to have the best lawn on the block, DR Power has everything you need to conquer your piece of the outdoors. Visit drpower.com today to learn more and shop the sale.
In this election, we each face a question. What kind of country do we want to live in? We choose freedom. The freedom not just to get by, but get ahead. The freedom to make decisions about your own body. We believe in the promise of America, and we're ready to fight for it. Because when we fight, we win.
I'ma keep on running because the winner don't quit on themselves.
Paid for by Harris for President.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Helper.
I'm Mary Mette. Thanks so much for joining us and being here. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there to support the show and get plenty of bonus content.
Yes, you're going to love this week's Thursday Throwdown. We have quite a scary message about an Antichrist that we feel like we would be remiss if we didn't let people know about. So make sure you join, and you'll also get our full interview as you do every week.
And I think, you know, if I may toot our own horn, I think we're asking a really important question. I mean, the big question on everyone's mind this week was, is Kamala Harris and the Democrats, are they anti-Semitic for not selecting Josh Shapiro as the vice president over Tim Walz? And this week in Thursday Throwdown, we explore the real question, which is Tim Walz anti-Semitic for just not being Josh Shapiro?
Right, right. If Tim Walz were less anti-Semitic, he'd probably be Jewish.
Yeah, and he'd be Josh Shapiro. He'd be Josh Shapiro. Yeah. So that's the kind of deep thinking that you're getting by tuning into Useful Idiots every single week.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, Walz is engaging in erasure.
Exactly
the
right.
The ultimate form of erasure by literally denying the existence of Josh Shapiro in himself. So yeah, you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Should we get to the four basic food groups?
Let's do it. What do we have for Democrat Suck?
So for Democrat Suck, we have some really depressing news, which is that Cori Bush, who was a member of Congress from Missouri and probably one of the most progressive members of Congress, was defeated by County Prosecutor Wesley Bell after AIPAC dumped over $9 million into the race because they wanted to remove Bush because she's been an outspoken advocate for Palestine. And she gave a really fiery speech after she was defeated in this disgusting race. Let's take a look at what she said. And then that's not the Democrat Suck part, obviously. That's a Cori Bush is actually a cool Democrat. Then we're going to watch a response to that, which would be the Democrat Suck. But let's watch this. Democrats can be inspiring until they're defeated by AIPAC clip.
Pulling me away from my position as Congresswoman. All you did was take some of the strings off. AIPAC, I'm coming to tear your kingdom down.
So Karine Jean-Pierre was asked about these comments, and let's take a listen to what she had to say about Cori Bush's comments.
Follow up on Cori Bush. She gave a speech last night after the results came in, and she said to AIPAC, who spent heavily against her, I'm coming to tear your kingdom down. Does the president have an opinion on that statement?
So, look, the president has always been very clear, and very recently after the assassination attempt of the last president, about lowering rhetoric, right? Lowering political rhetoric and the importance of doing that. It is important that we be very mindful of what we say. This kind of rhetoric is inflammatory and divisive and incredibly unhelpful. Look, we're going to continue to condemn any type of political rhetoric in that way, in that vein. And so it is important to be mindful in what we say and how we say it. But we cannot have this type of inflammatory, divisive language in our political discourse. Not now, not ever.
That is so encouraging. Not now, not ever. First of all, it would have been nice if Karine Jean-Pierre condemned AIPAC for not only intervening in this, but literally making racist ads that change the color of Cori Bush's skin and the shape of her forehead. But of course, Karine Jean-Pierre is not going to say anything against AIPAC. And the other thing is, in terms of incendiary rhetoric, shouldn't she have condemned her own boss, Joe Biden, for lying three times about 40 beheaded babies, which he said precisely so people would be horrified by Palestinians and tolerate Israel's genocidal assault on Palestinians.
The whole thing is so embarrassing. And now this is the second straight black progressive lawmaker that AIPAC has played a pivotal role in defeating. They also spent millions of dollars to defeat Jamal Bowman. And you look at both these cases and you have, like, you know, these black progressives who didn't make Palestine their main issue. Like, it's not as if Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman were going around making Palestine even their main issue. They're actually there to serve their communities. They just happened to support a ceasefire early on when nobody else in Washington would dare do that, which was in Washington, an act of real courage. So just for doing that and for standing up for Palestinian rights, minimal Palestinian rights, they get targeted with tens of millions of dollars from AIPAC. And everybody treats that as totally normal. And it's just like, what kind of a message are we sending in this country that, like, you know, you can overcome all the struggles that this country puts before you, especially if you're a person of color. In the case of Cori Bush, she's been through a lot in her life, became a community activist. She got elected to Congress. And then after one term, she gets ousted because she dared to call for a ceasefire in Israel's mass murder rampage in Gaza. It's just so cynical, and we all tolerate it. And let me, you know, say a few words about anybody who bought into Russiagate for a second, because compare this case of a foreign lobby buying an election and ousting elected lawmakers who dare to challenge a foreign state, and to the freak out about so-called Russian interference in our election. That was like the top focus for so many years. This fear of really what was a myth of Russian interference. It wasn't even true. The only thing that was true was that some Russian social media posts about, like, not even the election were put out on Facebook, which nobody saw. That was the extent of so-called Russian interference. But there was a national freak out for years and years and years. There was multiple investigations. There were hearings. This is on TV every single night. About really the equivalent of like a monster under the bed. It was a myth. But yet in real life, you have a foreign lobby spending millions of dollars to oust black lawmakers. And everyone treats that as completely normal. So normal that the White House, which is in the same party as these two Democrats, throws them under the bus and basically tone polices Cori Bush for being upset at being ousted for having a conscience. It's just, I mean, every day you find a new reason to be cynical about this system.
Well, Aaron, you may be just being anti-Semitic and blaming AIPAC, because how do we know that AIPAC actually played a role? Oh, actually, let's take a look at this tweet from AIPAC. The many have spoken. Congratulations to pro-Israel progressive leader Bell4MO on your big win against anti-Israel squad member Rep. Cori Bush. AIPAC and our 4.5 million grassroots members are proud to stand with Wesley Bell. Being pro-Israel is good policy and good politics.
Yeah, having $9 million to throw at an election in a Missouri district is actually the only politics that we're involved. If you want to call that politics,
right.
It's more like bribery, because they really basically bought Wesley Bell. They got someone who would be willing to throw Palestinian rights under the bus and go after Cori Bush, and they succeeded, and they're openly celebrating it. And that's them as good politics. It's so sick.
What do we got for Republican Suck?
For Republican Suck, we're going to have some more coverage of the freakout that ensued over the selection of Tim Walz as Kamala Harris's VP nominee, because there's a whole bunch of people from both parties declaring that because Josh Shapiro was not picked and because there was some criticism of Josh Shapiro's support for the Israeli government, that that must mean that he was not picked because of anti-Semitism. And this came from, you know, CNN posts, as we talked about on this week's Thursday Throwdown. It came from some Democrats. It also came from Republicans. And what's funny about that is that Republicans simultaneously position themselves as being against identity politics and against people from marginalized ethnic groups to dare, you know, invoke their ethnicity as a reason for, you know, them being oppressed or them being not given the opportunities that white people are given. But yet, when it comes to a Jewish person not being selected as the vice presidency, these self-styled anti-woke Republicans freaked out and declared this must be because of anti-Semitism. So here, for example, is J.D. Vance. Right before the nomination was announced of Kamala's selection, and J.D. Vance declared that if Josh Shapiro is not picked, then it must be because of anti-Semitism in his own party.
Well, look, if it's not Josh Shapiro, I agree with you. I think that they will have not picked Shapiro, frankly, out of anti-Semitism in their own caucus and in their own party. I think it's disgraceful the Democrats have gotten to this point where it's even an open conversation. And it is an open conversation.
I mean, can you believe these people? Like, if you watch Fox News or listen to all these talk shows, they spend, I don't know, the majority of their time making fun of, like, what they conceive to be woke people, right?
And DEI.
DEI, yeah, DEI, exactly, yeah. And now a Jewish guy is not picked for VP, and all of a sudden it must be because Democrats are anti-Semitic. And J.D. Vance, after the Walls nomination was announced, he continued with that theme.
I genuinely feel bad that for days, maybe even weeks, the guy actually had to run away from his Jewish heritage because of what the Democrats are saying about him. I think that's scandalous and disgraceful. Whatever you believe or whatever disagreements on policy you have about somebody, the fact that that race, the vice presidential race on the Democratic side, became so focused on his ethnicity, I think is absolutely disgraceful.
I mean, do these people believe in anything? Like, they're supposed to be anti-identitarian, right? That's supposed to be like their big thing. But yet they're screaming anti-Semitism simply because a Jewish guy wasn't picked to be the VP nominee. I mean, would they say that Trump is racist because he didn't pick Tim Scott to be his VP, right? Instead pick J.D. Vance? I mean, it's so crazy. And of course, I'd love to think that Josh Shapiro was not picked because he's a Zionist, because he volunteered for the IDF, because he spoke in a really bigoted way about Palestinians, saying that they're too battle-minded to make peace. But that apparently was not the reason. I wish it was, because Kamala Harris wanted to get away from like a pro-Israel position. But the real reason, apparently, is because Josh Shapiro was too ambitious in his political hopes, and Kamala Harris was fearful of that. And Tim Walz is a much more humble, you know, team player and has this folksy appeal. So that's why he was picked. But just for the gall of Republicans to now, mm-hmm, like, be such like the thing they decry in DEI people, it's just such a farce.
Yeah. And also, I mean, the only people talking about his ethnicity, they make it seem like there were a bunch of progressives being like, we don't want the Jew, anyone but the Jew. The only people talking about his ethnicity are the people claiming it was about anti-Semitism. And one of the things that people were critical about when it came to Shapiro was his Zionism. But again, only anti-Semites conflate being a Zionist with being Jewish.
Well, here is one more Republican doing that. That is Nikki Haley, who has this stark warning to share. Democrats are going to have to explain this movement towards deeper anti-Semitism we're seeing in the protests, in the rhetoric by the squad and members of Congress, and now in the VP pick. They can't talk this away as a coincidence. It's concerning. Again, this is the party that has Chuck Schumer as Senate Majority Leader, Antony Blinken as Secretary of State. He's the Antony Blinken after October 7th, went to Israel and said, I come here as a Jew, you know? So you really can't accuse this party of like not welcoming Jews into its ranks. And it's so crazy that we even have to defend the Democratic Party. That's how crazy the Republicans are.
I know, it really is.
You know, you can just so many examples, Ben Shapiro, all these people who've like made a lot of money positioning themselves as being anti-woke warriors, right? Mocking college students who, you know, speak about marginalized people, who talk about intersectionality, all these people now being identitarian in the most like ridiculous way. They're just such frauds, all of them.
Yeah, it really is ridiculous. They see anti-Semitism all over, even when it's not, and then they'll deny racism where it actually exists. Unbelievable. So for Isn't That Weird, let's take a look at a new story from the art world, because Aaron and I like to provide you not only with political news, but, you know, weather analysis, flight analysis, airport etiquette analysis, and the art world and the naked art world. So a museum in Marseille is celebrating its 10th anniversary by giving visitors the chance to see its current show in the nude. So they're having an exhibit, and it's called Naturist Paradises. And you can come and see this exhibit, which is about living naked. You can see this exhibit while being naked. So that's cool. I mean, you know, I went to Wesleyan, by the way, and there were nude dance parties, I think. I never went to any.
Yeah, all I can say is I would not go to this exhibition, and I support nudists. You know, I'm impressed by nudists, but I just don't have that. I just don't have the interest or the
no.
Yeah, it just doesn't do it for me.
Yeah, I don't want to be around it on either. Like, I would. I don't really want to be naked in front of other people I don't know, and I don't really want to see naked people. I don't mean to naked shame.
No, definitely not. No, go for it. If you have that confidence, I admire it. It's impressive, and go for it. To be honest, I'm also just not, I mean, I'm the son of an artist. My mom's an artist, but I got to say, I just don't, you know, I just don't go to that many art museums anyway. So I'm definitely not going to go to one.
Right.
Naked.
Yeah. Right. You know? This is definitely not going to be the one art exhibit you do go to.
Yeah. Yeah. But all the power to the nudes.
All the power to the nudes. Yeah. To the always nudes.
Okay. Isn't that terrible? We're going to turn to Israel. And this is a very, I mean, like anything to do with Israel, it's just extremely grim, but it has to be discussed because our country, our tax dollars are funding all of this. And all of our politicians are getting up every day saying our shared values, Israel's our friend. And meanwhile, Israel's showing us what those values are. And they're on top of mass murder of Palestinians in Gaza. They're also now, we've seen just in recent days, very clear messaging that Israel's values also include rape, sexual assault, where people are rioting over the rights of their self-declared rights of Israeli soldiers to sexually assault and brutalize Palestinian prisoners. And it's gotten so crazy that an Israeli TV network brought on an Israeli soldier who was involved in the sadistic rape of a Palestinian prisoner that was caught on security footage, and they brought on this Israeli soldier to like defend what he and his unit did. So this is the soldier. He's asked, what is your feeling in front of the army, in front of the prosecutor's office? And he says, I think our army is the healthiest army. The commanders, the fighters, the field men. If there's anyone in the system above who wants to spoil us, I'm here to protect our good name. And he's wearing a mask to protect his identity. And this is an actual thing happening on Israeli TV. A soldier who participated in a brutal sexual assault that led to serious injuries for the Palestinian victim is on television defending himself. And this is the country that we're told every day by our politicians that we have all these shared values with and is a beacon of light, the most moral army in the world, blah, blah, blah. And by the way, the irony of all this coming after months and months and months of a propaganda campaign in which we were told that Hamas committed mass sexual assault on October 7th. And anybody who dared question that, starting right here, was a rape denialist and blah, 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 blah. And in real life, there was no evidence for even a single case of sexual assault on October 7th. That remains the case today. And in real life, not only was that being done to manufacture consent for Israeli mass murder in Gaza, it was also being done to, you know, whitewash the fact that Israel actually practices sexual assault as a matter of policy, as we're seeing now with the fact that a soldier is going on TV to defend it. And where is Sheryl Sandberg and Hillary Clinton and, you know, all these op-ed columnists in the New York Times and Washington Post and The Atlantic magazine who are attacking us for challenging the fabricated claims about Hamas sexual assault? Where are they to condemn all this? Nowhere to be found. And in fact, as we're recording this, there still has not been pretty much any coverage in U.S. media of this open flaunting of Israeli sexual assault on TV. And so it's terrible, but it's real, and it has to be called out.
Yeah, it's absolutely disgusting. And you have members of the Knesset defending it as well, which is atrocious. And yeah, the most moral army in the world engages in sexual violence and rape. And the response of Israeli society is to riot when the soldiers responsible for that are detained. And as you pointed out, Aaron, it's receiving no media attention, even though it is receiving media attention in Israel. And I think it speaks to just how unhinged the society is that they don't even try to cover it up. You have members of the Knesset defending it. You have soldiers going on TV talking about it. But it's also worth noting that B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, put out a report verifying sexual assault. And I think people who for messed up reasons, won't listen to Palestinians are listening to B'Tselem. Yeah, so that is certainly terrible.
And those have been your four basic food groups.
When Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, he already had three missed calls from Chuck Norris.
We all know the man, the myth, and the legend of Chuck Norris. But did you know that in his 80s, he's still alive and kicking butt? Either that or death is too afraid to tell him the news. Chuck wants to share with you what gives him so much energy to work out, stay active, and keep up with his grandkids. He did this just by making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s.
And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/useful for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/useful.
This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
For this week's guest, we are joined by Rami Khoury. He is a Palestinian-American journalist, a distinguished public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C., frequent contributor to Al Jazeera, where he appears often on television and writes op-eds, and a veteran journalist who I've been following for a very, very long time. So we're very happy to speak to him. Just one technical note, because of some technical issues, Katie comes in a bit later into this interview, but does join us by the end. And it's a really great conversation. We hope you like it as we, you know, teeter with the increasing risk of a regional war in the Middle East. So it's great to hear from someone who is one of the most informed people on this topic. So here is Rami Khoury. Rami Khoury, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
As we're recording this, the world is awaiting a potential retaliation from Iran and Hezbollah to the recent Israeli assassinations in Beirut and Tehran of top Hamas and Hezbollah officials. I'm just wondering your perspective. What do you think is most important for people to know about the various actors here and their calculations as we enter this potential new phase of war?
You know, I've been covering the Middle East, living there, writing as a journalist and academic and other things, for about 55 years. So I've watched this over half a century. And the most striking thing to me in that entire period, I would say, since the late 1960s, is what we're witnessing today, the face-off between an Israeli-American alliance with much of the Western world, but not all of it, against a new alliance of forces in the Middle East, which is unlike the old ones, which was Egypt and Syria and Saudi Arabia and some individual countries, Algeria. But the alliance facing, confronting, resisting, and challenging the U.S. and Israel is a bunch of non-state Arab armed powerful actors, Hezbollah, Hamas, Ansarullah, the forces in Iraq and Syria, the popular mobilization forces, a bunch of non-state actors who are really powerful and closely linked to Iran. And this is the big confrontation now. So and the thing about this is we've seen this develop now. It's taken about 25, 30 years, after the Iranian Revolution, the birth of Hezbollah and Hamas in the 1980s. We've seen this going on now for about 30, 40 years, and they're very transparent. These forces in the Middle East, mostly Arab, some Iranian, we know exactly what they want. We know exactly what they don't want. What they want is not to be treated like children and puppets by the Western imperial powers and Israel. And this is particularly what Iran doesn't want. They don't want to be sanctioned. They don't want to be threatened. They don't want to be attacked. They don't want to be occupied. They don't want to be subjugated at will, as that had been their fate under the British and the Turks and the Russians and the French and then the Americans and coup d'etat. And they're fed up with that. And the Iranians are basically standing their ground. And these other groups with them are doing the same thing, but in their own context. So Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Palestine, Ansarullah in Yemen, these groups are saying, look, we are nationalist militant resistance groups. We are resisting the oppression and the threats and the savage attacks of Israel and the U.S. and allied forces with them. And we're not going to just sit there and take it like the Arab governments used to do in the past. And so this is the real new important dynamic that people have to look for. And in that context, I would say what we should look for in the current immediate situation, which is, as you said, the world is anticipating Iranian and Hezbollah, maybe Ansarullah retaliation because they were attacked, Hodeidah port was attacked. We're anticipating what's the reaction going to be, the retaliation. And we have to calculate that or anticipate that in the context of their own nationalist mindset. And so they may not have a big, massive military attack. This is what Israel and the West are assuming, because Israel and the West have used massive military attacks as their main instrument of statecraft in the region for many years. In fact, since Napoleon in 1798, the West has been here nonstop for 2.25 centuries, using its military might, ordering people around and getting its way most of the time. This is the first time that you have a really significant regional grouping that pushes back against these foreign, colonial, military, apartheid, racist powers. And this is what really matters most. And what this means in the details, sorry, it took me a long time to get to answer your question. What we should look for is, what do Hezbollah and Iran want the West and Israel to do vis-a-vis Gaza, vis-a-vis Palestinian rights, vis-a-vis the Palestinian resistance movement? And this is, I think, going to be the crucial thing. And my guess is we're not going to necessarily have big military actions and the stuff that CNN and the New York Times like. We're going to have probably a combination of some militant actions, possibly some cyber attacks, you know, some quiet stuff behind the scenes that rattles people. And more importantly, what you're going to get is a possible diplomatic breakthrough, which was hinted at today when the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt issued a statement today, meaning Thursday, August 8th, saying that they want all the parties, essentially Israel and Hamas, to get back to the negotiations and seal this ceasefire agreement for exchange of prisoners and hostages and other things, because all the details have been worked out, all the what they called the framework has been worked out, and they just have to work out the details, which the three powers who are leading the mediation say they can do. This is very significant for those three together to say this kind of thing with such force and specificity, and they're giving a timeline. I mean, this is like this is as close as we've gotten to the United States ordering Israel to, you know, get with the show. They've done enough in the genocide. They haven't achieved all their goals. They can keep killing lots of people. All it's doing is making the situation worse for Israel and for the U.S. and for the Democratic Party. So this is a pretty significant move, and I think the response to that move will be the place where I would look for the most significant retaliation by Iran and Hezbollah in cahoots with Hamas, which would be retaliation in terms of the agreement on the arrangements in Gaza immediately after the ceasefire happens, the exchange of prisoners and hostages happens, the slow withdrawal of the Israeli forces, humanitarian aid resumes, and things like that. So there'll probably be a period of some months. And then after that, you get to what people have called the day after. That is, I think, going to be the arena in which the Iranians and Hezbollah and their Arab partners strike back against what the Israelis did. But this is just my speculation. We're all speculating.
Yeah. Do you think it's fair to say that Israel wants Iran and Hezbollah to escalate because it wants an excuse to fight a direct war with Iran and Hezbollah? With Hezbollah, there's a long history of that. As you mentioned, Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982, which led to the creation of Hezbollah. In the process, Israel killed tens of thousands of people. And has always wanted to crush Hezbollah ever since, because Hezbollah can fight back. But if it's true that Israel wants a war with these people, wants to draw on Iran, do Iran and Hezbollah, do you think they're trying to factor that in, that they want to retaliate, but not in a way that gives Israel a pretext to go even further, as Israel has done many times before in its history?
That's right. And this is fascinating, because what you see in that, I don't know what you call it, not fit, tit for tat, but that, you know, your role and my role, what the two sides do is a kind of a manifestation of the old colonial relationship. And we've seen it again this week. And some people have said, Macron, the president of France, called the Iranian president Pezeshkian and said, you shouldn't do any retaliation. You shouldn't do any military retaliation. That's incredible. And some people are telling Hezbollah, just go and attack some vegetable gardens in Israel and don't attack anything else. Don't hurt anybody. Israel yesterday, Netanyahu, or this morning or yesterday, said that if any civilians are hurt in the retaliatory attack against Israel, that Israel would you know, do terrible things to Iran and Hezbollah. This is a guy who's just killed probably over 100,000 civilians in Gaza. It's unbelievable. And it's killing every day, 20, 30, 40 in the West Bank and 50 or 70 or 80 in Gaza. So this is the old colonial way. And this is precisely what the Iranians and the so-called Axis of Resistance are saying. We don't play by these rules anymore. And they're willing to take the risks of getting beaten up. And they've been beaten up in the past, and they'll probably suffer more beatings because of the immense technological power and advantage that the U.S. and Israel have, and their colonial spirit allows them to use that advantage in a savage way, as we've seen. We see today still in Gaza, there's still no sign that the U.S. or England or anybody wants to force the Israelis to come to a ceasefire. No sign at all. It's unbelievable. So the lesson, the conclusion, I think, that many people, including myself, draw is that the colonial era never ended in the Middle East. Maybe it ended in South Asia. Maybe it ended in parts of Africa. It never ended here. The colonial spirit that drives white, Northern European, American, Western, military, industrial, racist, apartheid, mostly white, Christian powers, that spirit of the colonial era is still with us. What gave us the apartheid in South Africa and the terrible destruction all over the global South is still being practiced in Gaza today as we speak. Today, Thursday, August 8th, 2024, when the French president calls the Iranians and said, don't retaliate militarily. And so this is unbelievable, but it's happening. And this is what is so significant about this new relationship that we're seeing. There's no way to predict where it's going to go, but Iran and Hezbollah and Hamas and others have developed very significant technological military powers. The Israelis and the Americans have much more significant, more powerful military and satellite and other capabilities. But with all of that advantage that Israel and the U.S. have, they haven't been able to subdue Hamas. 10 months now, they haven't been able to subdue Hamas. They haven't been able to slow down the spirit of resistance of people all over the region. And if you look at popular opinion and polling and other evidence, people are very much, ordinary people are very much willing to defy and resist Israel and the U.S. And they know it's costly. They know it's costly. But they also say that no anti-colonial liberation struggle has succeeded without people dying and paying a big price. In any country, including the United States, every country that fights an anti-colonial, anti-imperial war pays a heavy price because the imperial powers are stronger, and that's why they're there, because they have the military power. So this is the important thing that I think we need to look at. And what's fascinating to me also is there was a little mini summit in Saudi Arabia yesterday, Islamic and Arab countries, and the Saudis are evolving their position slowly in this. And what's fascinating is the countries that were seen to be buddy-buddy with the Israelis and in the pocket of the Americans, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, and the Sudanese and others, the people who signed, some of them signed the Abraham Accords. These countries are really showing that their political elites made good business deals with the Israeli elites and Jared Kushner and others, but there's no popular support in these countries of any significance. There's tiny little bits, but no serious popular support for the normalization of ties with Israel until there's a Palestinian state, after which people are willing to have perfectly open, normal ties with Israel. So this is, again, a link in this evolving regional and global battle of perceptions and wills between people in the Middle East and the Arab countries. You get it in Turkey a little bit, other places, and the United States. So as we, you know, as we see these events going on day to day, we have to not be drawn into the CNN, New York Times, MSNBC fantasy world of cartoon-like diplomacy and emotion and the projection of the U.S. as the great provider of peaceful life and democracy and prosperity and hope in the face of these barbaric Muslims and Arabs and Iranians and others. This is a fantasy world that has been created in the West. And a lot of people made a lot of money out of it, and they still do. But it has now started to shatter because two things have happened. The Israelis have revealed in all its ugliness the barbaric, violent spirit that is in their Zionist Israeli movement in the genocide in Gaza. The stuff that you see on TV, I don't know if people watch this stuff. I watch it almost every night, and it sends me to bed in tears sometimes. It's to watch babies with their heads cut off and parents crying for hours and people being bombed in their sleep and no water and no Israelis won't let medicine in. It's unbelievable the severity, the cruelty or the barbarism that the Israelis are practicing with the acquiescence of the United States, it seems. This is something that's unprecedented. And therefore, the resistance to this is equally unprecedented. And we don't know where this is going to end up. But what we do know is that for the first time ever in the colonial period, you know, you go take it back to Napoleon again, if you want, to the end of the 18th century, this is the first time that I believe, other than nationalist uprisings, say Algeria or Egypt or individual countries that had their nationalist uprisings, but we're on a regional level, the first time that people push back against the U.S.-Israel combine, which is the cutting edge of this Western imperial driving force. It's the first time we have competition. And the media in the West the mainstream media has played such a central role in propagating the various lies and exaggerations and racist stereotypes that have kept this conflict going for so long. They're losing their grip now because a lot of good people, including yourself and many others and many friends and colleagues of ours, have started to create alternative media that give you honest analyses And most of all, the Israelis have revealed the ugliness within their Zionist imperial movement and their savagery. The world, through the International Criminal Court, National Court of Justice, has ratified this. The General Assembly voting 153-6 or whatever it was several times. There's clearly a global affirmation that what Israel is doing is criminal, it's savage, it's illegal, it's immoral, it shouldn't happen, it has to stop. It's a genocide. And the last thing is that the expansion of social media all over the world has shattered the monopoly that Western mainstream media used to have, and therefore people can sit there in their homes and on their watches or on their phones and see babies with their heads cut off burning in schools that were safe zones that the Israelis bombed. So this is where we are today, and we have to make sure that we analyze situation using using those parameters, because my final statement here, I'm sorry my answers are a bit long, but I just want to make sure that we get this context right. What Israel is doing and what the United States is doing, what is Biden, we don't know about Kamala Harris and Trump, but Trump we kind of know. Trump wants money on golf courses, and he'll let the Israelis do whatever they want as long as they give Jared Kushner business deals. But the American government still is not fully clear about if there's going to be a change at all with Kamala Harris. For the moment, all we have is some softer words, which is good, but we don't have any significant change in policy yet. But the important point here is that what the Israelis and the Americans are doing is being forced to confront that they in Gaza represent the last example of the cruel, savage actions of a 19th century European colonialism still in action in the 21st century. It's the only 19th century colonial movement, that's apartheid movement, that's still active. They're still going off in the West Bank and grabbing people's homes and taking them and saying these belong to the Jews, belong to the Israelis, belong to the Zionists. And this is quite extraordinary. And the reason that the whole world, I think, is standing up as supporting the Palestinians, where you get 150,000 marching in the streets in Jakarta and London and I don't know where, it's because the whole global South sees this for what it is, which is the last anti-imperial, anti-colonial struggle against the two symbols of it, which was the Zionist movement in the late 19th century, which was really one of the last big imperial colonial movements that came out of the white European North, and supported by the United States, which is the latest of the Western powers that is involved in this kind of criminal activity. So I offer that broad analysis as a way to push people to get away from the CNN, New York Times kind of focus on, is this going to happen tomorrow? Is this going to happen? I mean, for the last 8 months, every morning I wake up, I read headlines, is there going to be a big regional war in the Middle East? And I've been saying, no, there isn't going to be. I've been saying that for the last 20 years. I lived through the last big war in Lebanon in 2006 and have watched many others. And it goes back to the question you asked. Iran and Hezbollah are very strong. They're willing to fight. If they're forced to, they will fight. And they take a chance, possibly. But Hezbollah fought in 2006 and forced the Israelis into a ceasefire, into withdrawal, into exchanges of prisoners, whatever they had to exchange. And they've maintained those new rules of engagement ever since. So the balance of power locally has changed significantly. Israel needs the U.S. to come in and fight for it. So Israel wants a war with Hezbollah and Iran, but it wants the United States to fight that war. Which the United States is not willing to do. Yesterday, the Chicago Council issued a poll that said that 55% of Americans do not want American troops to fight to defend Israel. That's quite amazing. Normally, you would have had 85% in the U.S. saying they will defend Israel whatever happens. They will still defend, the security of Israel as much as they can, but they don't want American troops going there to do that now. So we're seeing significant changes. The Israelis don't know how to handle this, and what we see is this madness that Netanyahu is leading with his right-wing fascist government.
You could tell, I think, that Netanyahu is anxious about declining support in the U.S. Just from his choice of focus during his speech before Congress, where he spent a very, very long time attacking not just the International Criminal Court, but also protesters against him and calling them useful idiots of Iran and saying they're all paid by Iran. I mean, I was surprised at how long he spent attacking protesters, which to me was a reflection of what you were talking about, the very tenuous position that he feels that he's in, where he's losing support around the world in ways that Israel hasn't before. I wanted to ask your response to a former Israeli national security advisor who's explaining Israel's mentality in the aftermath of its assassination of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, the Hamas political leader. So this former national security advisor for Israel is named Giora Eiland. And he said this to the Wall Street Journal: "We live in a region where no one appreciates anything but military force and the willingness to use it." And therefore, he added, the assassination of Haniyeh helps Israel to regain not only self-confidence, but also some abilities to deter our enemies. I'm curious your thoughts on that. His conception that the only language anybody in the Middle East understands is force, and that's why Israel has to constantly use military force everywhere.
You know, this is typical of what we've heard from Zionists and Israelis and Americans and Westerners and colonial powers. And many people have said similar things for the past couple of centuries. It's nothing new. It's totally unsupported by the evidence. And in fact, the historical evidence, as we see today, is exactly the opposite, is that when you mistreat people, you treat them like animals, you disregard their rights, their dignity, their whatever, they fight back. They sometimes don't fight back right away. You know, when the ancient Hebrews were exiled to Babylon, they just sat meekly by the rivers of Babylon and the water, and they couldn't do anything until one of the prophets, I think it was Ezekiel, I can't remember which one, and they came by, and according to the Bible, if you accept the Bible, I think the Bible's great pointers to some issues that people really believe, but the ancient Hebrews didn't do anything for years and years, and then they were able to get back into parts of Canaan, where they had the small little kingdoms where they lived, and then when the Romans and the Greeks and the Romans mistreated them, they couldn't do much, and then they fought back, and then when finally they were thrown out, couple of thousand years later, when they were mistreated by the Russians, especially, and the East Europeans, the Jews fought back. So people fight back. They don't accept permanent subjugation and dehumanization. When you look at the earliest accounts, which a book by the wonderful Israeli historian Ilan Pappe just came out, people should read this book. It's about the history of Zionist lobbying on both sides of the Atlantic. It's unbelievable. The earliest people who lobbied for a Jewish state were British Christian fundamentalists, imperialist racists, anti-Semites. And they wanted the Jews to go, and they were suffering in East Europe and Russia. And these white guys in London said, oh, let's have the Jews, before Herzl started talking about a Jewish state. In the 1870s, 1880s, just before Herzl, and the sentiments among these people were very similar. That they not only said that the local people there were unable to do anything, they needed our help to make them civilized. They totally ignored them. They totally ignored the Palestinians. The Palestinians do not appear in the records of the debates about whether Britain should support a Jewish homeland. If they appear, they appear as they did in the Balfour Declaration as the non-Jewish residents or something. And the same thing happened with the mandate of the League of Nations, of course, because we just took the Balfour Declaration. And the same thing is happening today when you look at the discussion about the so-called the day after. Among learned institutions in Washington and New York and London and other places and Tel Aviv, And they talk about, you know, Arabs should come in and the Emiratis and the Saudis should fund it and this and that. Israelis should provide security. And the Palestinians don't exist. I mean, they give lip service to the Palestinians. So this is an ancient tradition of imperial racist colonial behavior. And you still have people in Israel who believe this. And it's a tragedy that the Jewish people, the Israeli people are such talented people, but they're totally blind when it comes to the reality of the people that they have oppressed. And all the wonderful things they've done in science and technology and art and whatever are forgotten when they see a Palestinian in front of them who they either have to shoot or expel or put on blinders to make believe they don't see them. They don't exist. They're invisible people, like Ralph Ellison's invisible people in Harlem and New York City in the early 20th century. This is incredible. So this lineage of racist, colonial, violent action is something that is reappearing all the time in modern contemporary Israel, and we just need to call it what it is. But it doesn't matter what we call it. What matters is that people are fighting back against it for the first time, and we don't know who's going to win that fight. Hopefully, the fight will stop at some point, and there will be a ceasefire, and then there will be a permanent process of political negotiation. We'll see.
And what's amazing to me about this Israeli conception that they have no option but constant violence is that for decades, they've had the option of accepting a Palestinian compromise, which is, you know, for decades now, the Palestinian leadership, the PLO, and even sometimes Hamas have accepted a two-state solution. And all the Arab states have offered Israel this. They've offered Israel full normalization in exchange for an Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories, a just resolution of the refugee issue, and the creation of a Palestinian state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. That's been the offer on the table for a long time now. And correct me if I'm wrong, but was that not the main reason why Israel invaded Lebanon to begin with over 40 years ago in 1982? Because the PLO at that point was moving to accept a two-state solution. And so therefore, Israel's aim, after trying to provoke a Palestinian response inside Lebanon, invaded to basically destroy the PLO and negate the possibility of that very Palestinian compromise that the PLO was accepting.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
That was a great conversation, and I cannot wait to read that book, which is coming out soon.
Yes, Or Books has published some wonderful material on the Gaza crisis. They published that book, Deluge.
I never said
that word right. Deluge, which we covered on this show a few months ago. And now this book about Hamas, edited by Rami. And his co-editor, and it sounds great. And very grateful to Rami for joining us. It's great to have his insight.
And make sure you join our endeavor at usefulidiotspodcast.com so you can see the full interview with Rami.
Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.